We are joined live in the KODX studios once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Good afternoon to you.
Good to have you both here again.
Yes.
Yes. We'll try and make a habit of it for a while.
That would be good.
We got that calendars for you both.
Yeah.
Right.
So lots to squeeze in this week, starting with, beginning to talking about some of the candidates that are running. But prior to that, let's start out with city council doing some intervention this week.
Yeah. I talked about this before my enforced hiatus, and it's been going on for quite some time. The standoff between Nicholsville, Lehigh, and the HSD, the Department of the City of Seattle that oversees homelessness policy. Nicholsville runs several sanctioned encampments for homeless, tiny houses and the like. And along about March, the Low-Income Housing Institute, which was a sponsoring partner for those encampments, decided they didn't like the way Nicholsville does self-management. And of course, HSD has been at war with Sharewheel and Nicholsville because of that model for a number of years. And they were really the silent partner in this. So Lehigh came in and basically tried to take over the camps. So for the past several months, we've got one camp at Othello that they did, encampment that they did take over, and the residents have been on strike since then. Another encampment at North Lake where Lehigh was physically locked out. And the residents have been self-managing behind locked doors, locked gates, for the past several months. And, you know, Nicholsville and its supporters have been going to city council for months saying, you know, Lehigh is violating the terms of the lease. They're violating the original ordinance the city of Seattle passed in, I believe, 2015 that allowed sanctioned encampments and set out the terms for those contracts. And council has done nothing until magically this past week, Bruce Harrell, of all people, woke up and actually noticed that people were testifying about this and said, well, why don't you do mediation? And they're like, well, we've been asking you this for the past 3 months. So city council
Well,
has,
I think it's Lehigh that's not wanting to do the mediation.
Or HSD.
Yeah.
And so council directed mediation in the case between HSD and Lehigh and
they committed to trying to move forward on getting mediation done.
Yes.
They didn't have a plan, but
no.
And they're trying to develop a plan for that. And of course, it's all going to
Lord help us.
It's all going to hinge on whether Lehigh wants to do that. Sharon Lee, who's I think the executive director of Lehigh, she said that she is not willing to sit down at the table with anyone from Nicholsville.
No, this has been a total power play.
Mm-hmm.
And
that kind of is reflected in how Lehigh took over some of the tiny house villages. Like down in Othello, they moved in and tried to they set up surveillance cameras and they tried
They've spent about $100,000 in taxpayer money on security
for
what was a self-managed camp that wasn't costing anything for that.
Yeah.
So it really has been an untenable situation down there. But hopefully this will help move things forward. As you said, the plan still needs to be developed, and both HSD and Lehigh have been resistant to mediation. So
mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens. But it was certainly a positive step. And if HSD and Lehigh are resistant to mediation, council can do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if it does.
Yeah.
All right. Also this week, city council passing legislation regarding ADUs.
Yeah, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago when it passed out of committee. But this week, the city council took their final vote on amending the single-family housing zones to include accessory dwelling units. That bill passed 8-0 with Bruce Harrell absent. The bill allows one mother-in-law apartment in the main dwelling on a single-family zoned lot and one backyard cottage with some height and size restrictions. But it doesn't include other restrictions that were debated by the city council, like an owner occupancy requirement or that the property owner wait at least 1 year before they can apply for a permit to build a backyard cottage. That was an amendment that Lisa Herbold had put forward that no one else went for, or the ban on using accessory dwelling units as short-term rentals on Airbnb, for example. Now, Mike O'Brien was really happy to get the bill passed after working on it for at least 4 years.
Yeah, they've been talking about it a long time.
For a long time, yeah. But he did add a last-minute amendment for a study of how many accessory dwelling units will be used as short-term rentals. That amendment states that it's the city council's intention to limit the use of accessory dwelling units as short-term rentals. So this is going to obviously be an issue that comes up in the future as the Department of Planning does its study on how many accessory dwelling units are eventually used as short-term rentals.
Does O'Brien want that study in Seattle or Copenhagen?
No, it's to study it here in Seattle. And then have the city, you know, have the city present that to the city council members and have them discuss whether or not the law needs the single family zoning needs changes for making sure that accessory dwelling units are not exclusively or mostly used for short term rentals, but that they get provided as long term housing for residents of Seattle, not for tourists.
All right. Anything else in that?
Nope. Let's go.
All right. A new PAC is
yes.
in town.
I know of over the past decade of at least two previous serious attempts to get a progressive PAC going as some sort of counterweight to what the Chamber of Commerce has been doing lately. And one was finally launched this week on July 1st. Of course, it's very late in the primary election cycle, and they don't have nearly the dollars lined up, I'm sure, that the Chamber of Commerce does. I doubt Amazon, for example, will be contributing to it anytime soon. But the People for Affordable Living Seattle, or PALS is the name of it. And it's backed by a number of homeless advocates, neighborhood progressive neighborhood groups, et cetera. We'll see how it plays out, particularly for the general election. Certainly that kind of vehicle has been needed in Seattle politics for a long, long time. It's good to see something up and going. How successful they'll be, we'll find out.
All right. Anything else about PACs, or weave that into the...
We can weave it into the... Or maybe talk about it a little bit after we've gone okay. through the city council members.
Okay. Yes.
So for the past previous 7 weeks, Maria had been doing individual
districts
information
for the city council.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's other things on the ballot, too.
Yes.
Although you would hardly know it from the news coverage.
Oh, yeah. Most of the news coverage has been city council, the city council races, although not always very informative news coverage, which is why I went district by district to look at all of the different candidates, or as many of them as I could, running for each race. And if you want that information, you can go to our website, kodxseattle.org, click on the page for Eat the Airwaves, and there are podcasts from prior weeks.
That's true, yeah. But we currently are having technical difficulties with that, which we should have ironed out in a few days. So
Okay.
Well, by the time people get their ballots.
By the time the ballots arrive, that'll all be magically fixed.
Yeah, and the ballots get mailed in about 10 days, so mm-hmm. Watch your mailboxes.
Yeah.
And, those were very informative summaries, so I highly recommend them.
Thanks.
But so this week we're going to kind of do a corral all that information together and push it all into the sausage.
Spew it out.
see what comes out.
Let you hear if Jav and I were marking our ballots today, who we would vote for.
Yeah, that's the idea. Okay.
All right, so take it away.
Okay.
All right, let's start with King County Council. There's a couple of races on the primary ballot. In council position number two, Larry Gossett, who has been there since basically pterodactyls roam the skies, is running for re-election. He is a longtime civil rights icon in the city, and he is faced for re-election with two candidates. One is a Ethiopian whose name I'm going to totally butcher, Jermaine Zahale, I think is how it's pronounced. He's fairly progressive. I think the main rationale for his running is that he is more representative of Gossett's district now than Gossett, who is African-American, much of whose constituency now lives in South King County. I would go with Gossett simply because he's a known quantity, and he's been the most progressive voice on county council for many, many years. The third candidate in that race is Stan Lipman, don't vote for him. He's nuts. He runs for something every time around, and he's running in this council race also. King County Council number 8.
Now, an alternative read on District 2 is Gossett's getting fairly old now. He is, I think, 74. Another 4 years at the end of his next term will put him very close to 80, and some folks are thinking that he's gotten a little bit out of touch with the district. So if you want to vote for Zalme, I think is how you pronounce his name, I think you're safe to do that.
Yeah, I think he's a reasonable choice.
Yeah, and I might actually, if I were marking my ballot today, I might vote for him.
Mm-hmm. The other council race is position 8, which is West Seattle. In this race, there are no real good choices, honestly. Good Space Guy is running. Put him with Stan Lippman in the absolutely nuts, runs every time. And then the more likely general election candidate is a guy named Michael Naylor, who's brags about his opposition to the employee head tax, is very scared of homeless people, and is really a not a very good alternative to Joe McDermott, who has been kind of a problematic Democrat on the county council for a number of years. He's very centrist, very business oriented. His staff is as well. That's who they like to talk with. And but unfortunately, he doesn't have any real viable opposition that you would want on county council this time around. So I would reluctantly mark my ballot.
I would also reluctantly support Joe McDermott in that position.
All right. Any other county council positions?
Those are the two.
Nope.
All right.
And there's also two for Port of Seattle in the primary. Mm-hmm. Position number 2, Courtney Gregoire is not running for re-election. Priti Sandhar, Sridhar.
Yeah.
Ran in 2017.
I thought she was very good, and I supported her in 2017.
So did I. She was running against Peter Steinbrück, who had no obvious interest or experience in Port of Seattle, but basically won that seat based on name recognition. And so Sridhar is back again, and she is, to my taste anyway, a very strong candidate over the other 5 candidates in that race. Number 2 would probably be Nina Martinez, who looks viable as well. The person I definitely would not vote for is former Bellevue Mayor Grant Degenger. He is the business-backed candidate in a position that is Port of Seattle that has long been a problem in terms of the cronyism and business domination of the Port of Seattle. It's one of those corrupt agencies in the state, along with the school district, which we'll get to in a while. So I would definitely go for Sridhar in that race.
And then position number 5.
Yeah, Fred Fellerman, and who's the sort of lone strong environmentalist on the Port of Seattle Commission, is running for re-election and has as well deserved. He's done a very credible job on council. He is running against 2 people. One, a guy named Jordan Lemon, who has no apparent qualification for Port of Seattle at all. And the other...
I looked at his website. It's like, no.
Yeah. The other is a guy named Garth Jacobson, who is a former Preston Gates Ellis attorney and is definitely the stalking horse for big business in this race.
Yeah.
So I would definitely go for Fred Fellerman.
Yeah, I support Fred Fellerman in position 5, Fellerman in position 5 as well.
That brings us to City Council.
To City Council, yeah, and I'll just try to be quick on the 7 different districts. All the districts are running candidates this time around, and the two
multiple candidates and the two
at-large positions are the only council seats that are not up for election this year. District 1, I support Lisa Herbold. She's the incumbent. She's also the most progressive candidate in the race, and she knows a lot about the business of the city council. She also represents a whole lot of institutional memory in terms of how the city council works and what it does and what its goals have been for the last 15, 20 years.
Prior to being elected in 2015, and I think she's been a little cautious on city council. Part of that is because she only won by a few dozen votes in 2015. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, she was legislative aide to Nick Licata for 20 years.
Yeah.
So that's where the institutional memory comes in.
Yeah, so she's ahead in fundraising against COP Brendan Colding, who's now in the number two slot. He's running on a straight Republican platform. He was endorsed by Speak Out Seattle this week. And then her other opposition is criminal defense attorney Philip Tavel, who has no discernible policy positions, but has nevertheless earned the endorsement of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC while taking a donation from the owner of the Kitten Cabaret Strip Club, among other...
Didn't that get Heidi Wills in trouble decades back?
See me, other apparently see me contributions, but apparently nobody in the mainstream media is picking up on this. Now, The Stranger reported that the chamber will be spending $77,755 to support Tavel's campaign against Lisa, which will boost him well ahead of both Lisa and Brendan Colding. Plenty of money, I suppose, to spend on attack ads, since Tavel has no discernible policy positions to support.
Yeah, and Herbel, when she won that tight race in 2015, she was outspent 3-1. So she's been expecting that she was going to get outspent by a chamber-backed candidate.
It looks like that will be Tavel.
And we'll talk about the chamber's role in several races in a little bit.
Yeah.
Colding is one of three ex-cops who are running for council this year, which tells you, number one, the influence of the anti-homeless hate groups that have sprung up around Seattle in the past few years and the legitimacy they've been given in mainstream media. It's a really disturbing trend, and hopefully Colding does not survive the primary.
Yeah, and Speak Out Seattle is one of those groups. So they released their endorsements this week. I'll mention those as we go along. District 2, which is southeast, District 1 is West Seattle. District 2 is south and southeast Seattle. Bruce Harrell is the current incumbent, and he is not running for re-election. So there are a lot of candidates vying for this seat. Tammy Morales is my choice for District 2. She is a progressive choice. She also came very, very close to beating Bruce Harrell back in 2017. Now, unfortunately, the right-wing NIMBY, Ari Hoffman, is slightly ahead of her in the fundraising department, having taken a lot of money from real estate developers, and he has also earned the endorsement of Speak Out Seattle, the neighborhood anti-homeless.
One of the most repulsive, and this is a high bar, one of the most repulsive people running for city council this time.
Yeah, and he seems to be backed mostly by the white folks living in District 2. But only 31% of his money is from District 2 versus 55% for Morales. There are two other good candidates in this race, progressive candidates, Christopher Peguero and Phyllis Porter, but they're further behind in fundraising. And then there's the Seattle Chamber of Commerce pick in District 2. That's Mark Solomon, who works as crime prevention coordinator at the Seattle Police Department, one of those police department candidates. And he was a former security consultant and defense contractor. He'll be getting a boost of about $80,000 in spending from the Seattle Chamber of Commerce's PAC because they're his endorsed candidate, which will put him well ahead of the other candidates in fundraising in this race.
Yeah, the two candidates to not vote for, I would say, would be Omari Tahir Garrett, who's another chronic candidate who's kind of nuts, and Hoffman. And I would put them in that order. I would rather have Tahir Garrett on council than Hoffman.
Now, the real risk here, I think, is folks splitting their progressive votes between three progressive candidates, which could allow both Ari Hoffman and Mark Solomon, the Chamber of Commerce candidate, to make it through the primary to the November ballot. And I think that's why the Seattle Chamber of Commerce is putting so much money behind Solomon. So I'm going to suggest that if you really want to vote strategically, that even if you like Christopher Peguero or you like Phyllis Porter, I would vote for Tammy Morales and just try to have everybody unite their votes behind the most popular progressive candidate in the race in order to make sure one progressive candidate gets through to the final.
Yeah, and Morales has a ton of endorsements and has been decent in fundraising. I supported her when she ran against, Harrell, a couple of years ago. And I like her a lot. I'm torn because Christopher Peguero is a personal friend.
And he is a good candidate,
He was a key person in the Seattle Race and Social Justice Initiative that's been gutted under Murray and now Durkin. He is a gay Latino man and is extremely progressive as well. But, it's hard when you've got three good candidates running in the same race.
Yeah. So for District 3, Capitol Hill, First Hill, the Central District, and North Beacon Hill, Shama Sawant is the incumbent, and in my opinion, she's the most progressive candidate in this race. She's earned
By far.
Yeah, she's earned a lot of enemies from the business community and from folks with money in her district and all throughout Seattle, because she's taken on the cause of many residents who don't have a lot of political power and don't have a lot of money. But I think that's what makes her extremely valuable on the city council. Now, she has also foreseen, like Lisa Herbold, that she would have a lot of Chamber of Commerce support behind her opposition. So she decided not to take democracy vouchers, and she has raised more than double what any other candidate in the race has raised so far, $182,000. She's done that, like I said, by not taking democracy vouchers, but also by reaching outside the city of Seattle to people who support progressive and socialist candidates throughout the United States. So a full 50% of her donations are from outside the city of Seattle, and only 22% are from District 3. So
the interesting part of that is that they tend to be much smaller donations than
her
opponents as well.
They do, whereas other candidates in the city council elections have taken considerable amounts of money from outside of Seattle, particularly Deborah Juarez. Their donations tend to be large infusions of cash from, for example, real estate developers. On the other hand, Shama Sawant has taken donations, a lot of very small donations, and many people who have given, you know, a weekly or monthly contribution to her to add up to a larger donation when you look at her donation lists. So
and the interesting thing about
that's the difference there.
Interesting thing about the Chamber of Commerce PAC, which of course is going to be spending heavily on this race as well, is that once you get past the really large donors, Amazon and the Chamber itself, number three and four on the list, excuse me, are Comcast and Puget Sound Energy. Mm-hmm. Now, both of those are concerned about the possibility of municipal broadband, which would take business away from them, heaven forbid.
Yeah.
And Sawant's been the leading voice on council in favor of that, as well as a number of other progressive issues. So that donation to the Chamber PAC seems squarely aimed at trying to get Sawant off council.
Yeah.
And I think especially in the general election, depending on who gets through, you're going to see a lot of money pouring into that race.
Yeah. Now, in terms of fundraising, the pro-business Logan Bowers has raised about $90,000, but only 41% of his contributions are from District 3. The clueless Amy Nguyen has raised $79,000, and conservative NIMBY crank Pat Murakami has raised about $78,000. But Nguyen, who's a newcomer to Seattle, is struggling to win endorsements and to express a platform that accurately reflects city politics. Murakami's main endorsement is the NIMBY organization Speak Out Seattle. The Chamber of Commerce's candidate in this race is Egan O'Ryan, who's far back in the field in terms of money raising. He's raised only $55,000, which I find to be kind of surprising since he is a big gay pride activist. But he'll be the beneficiary of the chamber's biggest expenditure in the city council elections. They say that so far they have spent $107,405 to support him, and that's going to boost him closer to what Sawant has available to spend.
Yeah, so, and the main reason he hasn't gotten a lot of grassroots support is that the gay money is being split between him and Zachary DeWolf, who's a school board member running for this race also.
Yeah.
And who's fairly progressive and not really sure why he's running against Sawant other than he lives in the district.
Well, I have a theory about that, and my theory is that he doesn't have much of an attention span and he's bored by sitting on the school board.
Oh, no doubt.
And there are folks who follow school board politics who have not been impressed with his performance in been about a year and a half that he's been on the school board. It also speaks to the fact that he may not have the staying power to sit for four full years on the city council. He's pretty far back in terms of fundraising in this group, and I don't think he'll make it through. So
yeah.
I support Shama Sawant in this race.
Yeah, me too.
Now, in District 4, there are two good progressive candidates in this race, and who you support might depend on how you feel about the word socialism. If, like me, you're not afraid of socialism, then labor activist Sean Scott is the candidate that you might want to vote for. He's the candidate I would vote for in this race. He's also the leader in fundraising, but only 32% of his contributions are from District 4. So his support with voters in his district may turn out to be kind of thin. Now, the other progressive candidate that has raised a lot of money and is now in the number two spot in this race is grad student and labor activist Emily Myers, who a lot of folks might be really comfortable voting for, and she would be my number two choice in this race. She has 49% of her contributions from District 4, so she could very well be the leader in votes in this race. Third in the amount of contributions is Alex Peterson. He's a former aide to City Council member Tim Burgess. Peterson is not far behind Scott and Myers in fundraising. He has about 45% of his contributions from District 4, and he recently won the endorsement of the Chamber of Commerce PAC, who said that they'll be spending $12,455 to support him in this race. So it looks to me like the Chamber thinks that the progressive vote is going to be split between Scott and Myers, and that that will allow Alex Peterson to make it through to the final.
Yeah, and I would say that Peterson is more progressive than the Chamber is probably giving him credit for. And certainly more progressive than you would expect for somebody who is an aide to Tim Burgess. I've been with him at different public events where he, expressed support for Shama Sawant's agenda, for example, and his other stances at the time were consistent with that. Now he's probably toned that down a little bit in order to get the Chamber.
Yeah, in fact, I found it really difficult to find any policy platforms anywhere amongst his on his website or amongst his campaign.
Yeah, I think he's being
mailers.
Very cautious about that.
Yeah, I think he's being too cautious, actually. In this district, he should be able to state his policy platform well enough that people get a good sense for who he is and not have to look to his endorsements and say, oh my God, the Chamber of Commerce, I'm not voting for him.
Yeah, the one candidate in this race definitely not to vote for, in my opinion, would be Kathy Tuttle, who brags, actually, that she was endorsed by Richard Conlon, which ought to be disqualifying in itself. But seems like a sort of a NIMBY type neighborhood activist that would be a bad news on
her. Her main progressive credentials are environmental, but when it comes to all the other issues that the City Council looks at, from homelessness to housing and affordable housing issues to police reform, she doesn't really have a coherent or consistent policy platform to evaluate.
Yeah, and I would say that's another one where not really clear on what council does.
Yeah, exactly.
There's quite a few of those.
You want to avoid candidates that just don't really know what the City Council does. Now, in District 5 is North Seattle, from Broadview on the west side of the city to Cedar Park and Matthews Beach on Lake Washington, including the neighborhoods of Maple Leaf, Howler Lake, and other North Seattle neighborhoods. This is Deborah Juarez's district, and she's running for re-election with the backing of real estate developers and the Chamber of Commerce. But the progressive candidate in this race is her opponent, John Lombard. He is a community organizer and he is very neighborhood focused, but he's also an environmental activist with a lot of good credentials. Interestingly, in this race, Juarez is still reporting that she hasn't received any democracy vouchers, while I'm sure she probably has, and her staff is just not on the ball with that. And I think that might be a campaign or election violation. Now, while only 16% of her contributions, get this, only 16% of her contributions have come from inside her district, and 36% from outside the city of Seattle, she's also going to get a small infusion of cash from the Chamber of Commerce for the primary. Probably she'll get a lot more cash for the November election.
And I would say that of the people who've come onto council in the last 4 years, she has been by far the worst.
Yeah, she's spent most of her time on big projects like the waterfront park downtown or the redevelopment of Northgate Mall to include an ice rink for the NHL team, as well as the redevelopment of the Key Arena. And when I looked at her background, that was what I saw, is that she has a background of working on behalf of real estate developers and developing these big, fancy showplace projects that really cater mostly to tourism and are not necessary really for the everyday, day-to-day life of a city.
Let alone in her district, which is Northeast Seattle.
Yeah.
And I will never get over watching her in a council session once berate the audience that she's not a sellout. She can't be a sellout because by definition, she's a woman of color.
Yeah.
And she was very indignant about
it. She plays that card a lot.
And yes, she does.
And it really is hard to watch.
Disingenuous.
Yeah.
In the extreme.
Yeah. Now, District 6, which has turned out, in my opinion, to be the most conservative district in the city in terms of this election,
this race
by far.
Is awful.
Yeah, this Ballard, Fremont, Finney Ridge, and Green Lake. This was Mike O'Brien's district, and he chose not to run for re-election this year. And looking at the candidates that are getting support in this district, I can see why. It was a thankless job the last year or two for him. I have been supporting John Lisbon as a progressive candidate because I think he understands the different programs that the city council has in place for things like dealing with homelessness and affordable housing. Jav has a different take.
Yeah, I keep hearing from people who are have seen him in town halls and panels where they were really kind of appalled by some of the homelessness issues, statements that he made and various other things like that.
So he may be swinging to the right now just to reflect his district, I think.
And, I mean, there's plenty of other people in the race who have better credentials in terms of hating the homeless. Kate Martin would be one.
Exactly.
John Peebles, an ex-cop named Sergio Garcia, who's mostly notable for the grossest handlebar mustache I've ever seen.
Yes, he's the man with the mustache.
Yeah, he's an ex-cop also, another one. And, there really are no really good candidates. My pick would be Kara Cervello, only because I have history with her. She's a volunteer alumnus of Eva State from many years ago, mm-hmm. and has been working to try and boost small businesses for the past number of years. But as far as I can tell, she really is the only truly progressive candidate in the race.
And she hasn't raised much money or done much campaigning, so that makes it really hard to...
Yeah. This is also the race where Heidi Wills is attempting her political comeback. And Wills is, when she was on council in the mid-90s, she was a very ambitious young quasi-progressive Democrat who also appealed to the business community and sort of twisted whichever way the wind blew and wound up losing her council seat because she took donations from the Rick's Strip Club in Lake City. It's hard to tell what lessons she learned from that, whether the lesson was to... be more cautious about who your supporters are, or whether the lesson was I can take money from anybody. it seems like the latter this time around.
Yeah, no, she doesn't seem to have improved much in the clueless category. She's running against Jay Fothy, who is a doctor, long very good history in the medical community, but he's turned out to be just as conservative as all the other candidates in the race. And I think a lot of the folks running in is kind of disturbing to me looking at the candidates in District 6. A lot of them express a lot of racist sentiments or kind of subtly racist sentiments.
This is the field that crawled out of Next Door.
Basically. Yeah, and thinks these sentiments, I think, in response to the fact that there's a man of color running in the race, Jay Fothy, and I find that so disturbing that if you have to hold your nose and vote for him, then maybe that's what you have to do.
Yeah, there are no real good choices.
There are no real good
race.
Choices in District 6.
As frustrating as I found Mike O'Brien to be over the years, it's definitely going to be a downgrade in that.
Yeah, now the Chamber of Commerce has given their endorsement to both Heidi Wills and Jay Fothy in this race. Speak Out Seattle, the neighborhood NIMBY group can pretty much list the people. You can pretty much go down their list and say and strike those people off your, and say I'm not voting for any of these. They endorsed Heidi Wills, so that shows you that she's not much more progressive than any of the other candidates in District 6.
Yeah, my favorite one in terms of inappropriate website statements on this one was John Lisbon bragging about on homelessness. He wants to support proven solutions like Housing First. Now, this tells me that He's not particularly aware that the city has been grossly misrepresenting the statistics from that program, and it hasn't been very successful. So he's either not very savvy about it or he's being really disingenuous. But that kind of establishment, blind establishment support is disturbing to me.
Yeah. Now, I took that to mean the Housing First model, which is actually a good model. But the city's program has not been following that model, the idea that you get people into housing first and then you meet them where they are in terms of treatment for drug addiction or help with other services that they need.
Yeah, that's a fine model if there's housing to put people mm-hmm. in. But there's not, and the city's solution to that has been the voucher program, which has been a total disaster. And then they wildly inflate the number of people who found permanent housing.
Well, the voucher program's been good. It just hasn't been sufficient because, as you said, there's not enough housing. And once the vouchers run out, their rent increases to the point where they can't afford it and they're back on the street.
Yes, although the city,
which is where we
the
get
city counts
cycling
those
through.
After three or six months mm-hmm. as permanently housed, and there's no follow-up. It's very disturbing. It's mm-hmm. you know, a master class in how you can lie with statistics.
Yeah. Now, at the same time saying we want to go to more and more statistics because that's what is how you get to success.
Garbage in, garbage out,
yeah. Now, in District 7, which I had expected to be the most conservative district, but is second place behind District 6. District 7 is my district, downtown, South Lake Union, Belltown, Queen Anne, and Magnolia. Sally Bagshaw is the current council member who's decided not to run for re-election. Andrew Lewis is the guy I would vote for in District 7.
Me too.
He served as campaign manager for Nick Licata's 2009 re-election campaign. He's also served on the city's Rental Housing Inspection Stakeholder Committee and the Seattle Human Rights Commission. He is also a Seattle public prosecutor in the city attorney's office, so he's been part of that whole move to divert people with drug addictions out of jail and into treatment, and to not throw people in jail automatically for minor crimes, but to try to work with them in order to make sure they don't keep cycling through the criminal justice system.
Yeah, and after that 2009 gig with Nick Licata, he went down to grad school at UC Berkeley mm-hmm. where he studied under Robert Reich.
Yeah.
So that tells you where he's coming from.
Yeah. Now, affordable housing is his bailiwick, and he's very good on talking about ways to acquire and build affordable housing and ways to fund it. He also knows city programs and what the council does on a day-to-day basis,
which is
few candidates in running for city council this year.
Yes, that recommends him alone.
Yeah, and unlike just about all the other candidates in this district, with the exception of Jim Pugel, who also is somewhat knowledgeable about the city council. But Pugel is backed by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC,
former cop.
Yeah, and who also threw their support behind Michael George, who's a shill for real estate developers and who's also, get this, won the endorsement of the Speak Out Seattle crew. So you do not want to vote for the guy whose name sounds like he's a pop star. You want to vote for Andrew Lewis. I want to vote for Andrew Lewis, and I would hope you would agree with me in District 7.
Yeah, and this also features the candidate, and Maria talked about this a little bit last week, Danielle Lipscomb-Eng.
Oh, yeah.
Who is my favorite clueless website statement of anybody running this year, that she wants in her first 30 days to do an independent audit of Seattle City Council. Now, I'm not sure what that means, whether she wants to audit how the council's staff spends its money or what exactly that means. I'm not sure she knows either. But in order to do that, she would have to get other council members to agree with her. And not only are they not going to agree with her on that, but they probably hold it against her for the rest of her term on a legislative body where she has to work with them.
Yeah.
So I think she understands how council works at all.
I don't think she understands the budget process there, that the budget is an open process. It's hammered out in public. People have access to it. You can go online and see it. And then the city auditor's department, the city audit department does actually audit some aspects of the budget from time to time.
Yeah, I think she heard Tim Iman say the word audit.
And she thought it was a good idea. Yeah, no, and that's very true for a lot of the city council candidates this year. They think they know how the city council works, but they actually don't. Now, as I said, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC, which is called the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy, is so far the only PAC who's reported independent expenditures in the council races, although that will probably change. There will probably be more PACs jumping in and making expenditures on behalf of candidates as we go along. Case has collected almost $1 million and so far spent more than $300,000 to support their favorite candidates in a number of different ways, including canvassing, phone calling, texting, printing campaign literature, and sending out mailers to support their favored candidates. And so far, they're concentrating on defeating Lisa Herbold in District 1, Shama Sawan in District 3, and trying to keep Tammy Morales from making it through the primary in District 2. Those are the three districts where they've put most of their money so far up for the primary.
And those are three of the strongest progressive candidates running this year.
Yeah, and that means that they, like I said, they think Alex Peterson in District 4 will make it through the primary, and that Deborah Juarez in District 5 will easily make it through the primary, and I agree with that one. I'm not necessarily sure whether Peterson will make it through if Sean Scott can muster enough support from renters and UW students. Emily Myers seems to have a lot of support from UW students and from folks who are labor supporters. So it looks like she may easily make it through to the primary. Now, the chamber seems to be less worried about one or both of their favored candidates in District 6, which is Heidi Wills and Jay Fothey. And District 7, which is Jim Pugel and Michael George. So that's their strategy. I think I pretty much agree with them on most of these, except perhaps District 4 and District 7, where I don't think Michael George will make it through.
And this is a PAC that got kicked off with $200,000 from Amazon, another $150,000 from the chamber and its members. And
like you said, a big donation from Comcast as well.
Comcast and Puget Sound Energy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're 3 and 4 on that list.
Yeah. Now there are two, did you want to talk about the ballot measures or?
Yeah. I'm not sure how these got inserted in the middle of the candidates, but let's go ahead and talk about them. There's two propositions.
Yeah.
One a county, one a city.
Yeah. The City of Seattle Libraries for All levy, will replace the expiring library levy from 2012. Now, the new levy is $219 million, is almost double the 2012 levy. But when you look at what it funds, I think you see that it's a good levy, and I'm going to vote yes on it. It would fund things like 10,000 more hours at Seattle libraries, including an extra hour every evening on the weeknights. It would allow some branches to open on Friday that currently don't, and it would extend hours at other branches. It would purchase more ebooks and audio recordings, eliminate overdue fines. It would maintain and improve the very popular Peak Picks collection for new books, folks who can get new books without having to put them on hold or wait for them. It would replace and update the aging technology infrastructure, like the public internet access, computers used to catalog and track library materials and to update the library's very outdated website, in addition to maintenance of the library system's buildings, including earthquake retrofitting for the University District branch, the Columbia branch, and the Green Lake branch, all historic older buildings.
Yeah, and the past levy and the capital portion of it funded a number of new branch libraries, which were
fabulous. Desperately needed.
Yeah. Now, this levy is why David Preston, the ex-verbal Speak Out Seattle person, was clutching his pearls over Drag Queen Story Hour in order to try and gin up opposition to this levy, but I don't think it's going to work. I think it will pass. So yeah. I would vote yes for it also.
Yeah, now the other ballot measure is King County Proposition 1. That's the Parks, Recreation, Trails, and Open Space levy that would also replace a levy that's expiring. The new levy would collect 18.32 cents per 1,000 assessed value in property taxes to fund parks, trail construction, and maintenance, and new open spaces. It would fund operations and improvements at parks throughout the county, including the Woodland Park Zoo, the Seattle Aquarium, and maintenance at public pools. It would also fund new land acquisitions, habitat restoration, and environmental education programs. So I think we should, I would like to vote yes, and I would hope other people
would join
do
you
the
in
same.
That sentiment, yes.
Okay.
All right. And then last but not quite least is the Seattle School District positions. There are three of them. A word on the Seattle School District Board. It is chronically underfunded. They have very limited access to their own staff. And so they're heavily reliant on senior staff from the school district itself, which has a lot of institutional problems. And because there's so few resources in the board positions, it's supposedly a part-time position to oversee 113 schools, a bunch of valuable real estate, and you know hundreds of millions of dollars a year in budgets. They can't possibly do it. So they tend to get led around by a ring in their nose by senior staff. Now, the school district itself is facing yet another budget crisis. This one is a combination of the new state funding model for K-12 and the fact that Seattle, as the largest urban district in the state, has a much higher percentage of special needs students. So their overhead is higher. That being said, for all three of these races, the vast majority of candidates seem to have no clue how the school board works or what his authority is or have any relevant background. Having a kid in Seattle Public Schools does not qualify you to run the school board. That being said, in District 1, Michael Christofferson is the only person who has acknowledged, I can tell in the race overall, who has acknowledged that fiscal crisis. And he's also the only one talking about cutting administrative positions, which the school district has been top-heavy for administration for decades. So good for him for at least asking that question. There are three others running in that race, the worst of which is a woman named Darcy Klein, whose rationale for running apparently is that schools are teaching kids to subvert their parents. Oh, noes. like I said, a lot of people running for these positions who seem to have no clue what they do and have no relevant qualifications. In District 3, my pick would be Chandra Hampson. She has a finance background. She studied grad school finance at Stanford, so she's probably fairly smart.
Desperately needed on the
school
board.
Yeah, and that is a skill set that is relevant on the school board, very much so. She's also president of the Seattle PTSA, so she's been supported by PTSA members to get to that position. So I think she's a fairly strong candidate in that race. And then District number 6, the incumbent is Leslie Harris, who has not particularly distinguished herself on the school board, but she at least understands what the board does, which is more than can be said for her two opponents who have no apparent qualifications for the school board whatsoever. So I would go with Michael Christofferson, Chandra Hampson, and incumbent Leslie Harris. Now, for the primary, only people in the districts vote for those races, and then it becomes a citywide race for the general election.
All right.
And that's it. I will post those on Facebook also in case people weren't taking notes. And they're my picks anyway, subject to change over the next 2 weeks. And then we'll see what happens over the next couple of weeks and what kind of last-minute money comes in from different PACs.
Yeah, and I will try to get the time to type up and post mine as well.
All right. So that gives us just under 10 minutes left to cover some national.
Okay, can we do it in 8 minutes and remind people that you're listening to KODX? And if you find this information valuable, throw some money our way. We're a volunteer operation, listener supported, and we need your money to keep doing this kind of work. So it's really valuable, and we really appreciate the people who have supported us.
So visit our website at kodxseattle.org, and there's button that you can click on.
Yes, and once the technical problems are finished, you can also access all those city council archives.
Yeah, and if you want to make a one-time donation, I think you just scroll down towards the bottom of the website. There's a PayPal button. You can make a single donation, or you can write us a check and make it out to Earth on the Air, Independent Media, and mail it to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145.
We have to ask Mike every time because we can't remember that long string of numbers.
So immigration, a couple of court decisions this week.
Yeah, two court decisions this week. On Tuesday, Judge Marsha Peckman of the U.S. District Court here in Seattle blocked an attempt by the Trump administration to lock up asylum seekers indefinitely. Peckman ruled that asylum seekers have the right to a prompt bond hearing so that they can be released from detention. Holding all asylum seekers in jail indefinitely violates their Fifth Amendment right to due process under the Constitution of the United States. Peckman had ruled in a previous case that asylum seekers are eligible for bond unless the government can prove that they pose a flight risk or are a danger to their community. And
to be clear, the Trump administration's locking up of asylum seekers has been blatantly illegal from the get-go.
Yeah. So. And also, you know, when you're looking at flight risk, which is what the Trump administration always says is their reason for locking people in detention, these are people with families, with kids. They can't just pick up and run on the spur of the moment. When they move, it's a long and considered process, and we should take that into account when we ask ourselves, why did they cross two countries. Why did they cross the whole country of Mexico to get across the border and into the United States? I doubt once they're here that they're going to be a flight risk.
Yeah, and you know, the whole Trump administration approach of we'll make it so miserable that they won't flee really is not an understanding of what they're fleeing, because no. In many cases it's a life or death decision.
Yeah,
it really is grim in the northern Central American countries these days.
Yeah,
and the Trump administration, of course, has also cut off all aid to those countries, which is just making things worse.
And the fact that it's grim in places like El Salvador and Honduras is not a good excuse for holding asylum seekers in horrific conditions. This week, U.S. District Judge Dolly M. Gee in California ordered a mediator to improve the health and sanitation at Border Patrol facilities in Texas as soon as possible. Judge Gee had appointed the mediator last year to ensure that problems reported at detention centers were addressed. But since that time, the facilities have grown worse, with recent reports by lawyers, Democratic lawmakers, and this week an auditor at the Trump administration's own Department of Homeland Security revealing shocking conditions in some of these facilities. Some of the photos and videos show things like children held in cells with concrete floors and no beds, with no access to soap, showers, clean clothes, or even adequate food.
Or toothbrushes.
Apparently, some of them are being fed for weeks on only bologna sandwiches and nothing else. Families are being held in overcrowded conditions behind chain-link fences like you would see in some of the worst refugee camps after a natural disaster, or in war-torn conditions in impoverished countries around the world.
Yeah, there's a reason these places are being called concentration camps by some people. They really do meet the technical definition.
Yeah, now people of all ages in these shelters are being forced to sleep on concrete or on the ground with only a foil sheet to cover them. Men and women are being held in cells that are so overcrowded they literally can't sit down, much less lay down.
For weeks at a time.
Standing room only for days, if not weeks, on end. And those are the kinds of prison conditions that you would expect to find under some of the worst dictatorships around the world. Seven children so far have died while in immigration custody in the past year alone.
That we know of.
Yeah, after more than a decade with no child deaths. And plenty of families came across the border under the Obama administration. So there were lots of kids that have passed through immigration custody in the last 10 years who were not did not fall ill and die. Donald Trump tweeted a response to these appalling conditions this week. And his response was, quote, "If illegal immigrants are unhappy with the conditions in which the quickly built or refitted detention centers, just tell them not to come. All problem solved, ! Well, and I have to say, no, the problem is not solved. Those people are here now. And while they're here, they're the responsibility of the U.S. government and of Donald Trump. And the government needs to get together. Donald Trump needs to order them to fix the problem now.
He's not gloat
about it like an idiot.
He's not going to, because he's playing to his base, who are
idiots. Yeah. But what really needs to happen legally is these folks need to be given a hearing date and released, exactly the way the Obama administration did it.
And exactly the way the law is written.
Yeah, the way the law is written. And it's going to take far too long for this to work its way out through the courts. So if you hear about or read about protests regarding the Trump administration policy, I would think that would be a really good time to ask yourself, why am I not getting out of my chair and getting up and doing something?
And we'll get to that when we get to events.
Yes, we will.
All right. Anything else on those?
Also on the court docket, the Trump administration reversed itself after filing acknowledgement. We talked about this last week, where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration and its efforts to add a citizenship question to the census, which is an effort that is squarely intended to benefit Republicans and benefit older white people at the expense particularly of Latinos and Democratic-leading districts. So after filing paperwork saying they would abide by the decision, the Department of Justice and the Trump administration and Donald Trump himself reversed that policy and said, no, we're looking at ways to try and get around that Supreme Court ruling, even though we swore in court that the drop-dead date for starting to print the census forms was July 1st.
Yeah.
Now, the Census Bureau is saying that they've gone ahead and started printing those forms. So I'm not sure what Trump has in mind. He's probably not sure either, other than he's running for re-election.
Well, there's rumors that he's considering an executive order, but the census is overseen by Congress, and the way to get around a Supreme Court decision would be for Congress to pass a law, not for the president to try to step in and issue an executive order that would not have the force of law in this case.
That would require a president who wants to acknowledge that Congress exists.
Yeah, and this guy doesn't. By this guy, I mean Donald Trump.
Yes, but he did get his military parade this week. That was exciting. as Repugnant and Martin Luther King, I'm sure, and the Greensboro sit-in students were spinning in their grave when he invoked them.
Giving a speech where he talked about airports during the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
Which led some folks to question whether or not he has dementia. But, you know, that's
not a new question.
From having watched a recent press conference in Japan where he talked to foreign reporters, I'm convinced he does not have dementia. He's just what Rex Tillerson said he was, which is a moron.
Yes, as well as an arrogant narcissist.
Yeah, somebody who thinks he's not stupid and the greatest thing.
And profoundly incurious.
Yeah, thinks that he has a very high opinion of himself, but he's not very bright.
No.
Events.
Yeah, we talked about the immigration situation. There are national events coming up this coming week. Several different locations are doing a Lights for Liberty vigil in support of immigrants.
Yeah.
That will be on Friday from 7 to 9 p.m. Yeah. There's one in Lower Queen Anne, one in West Seattle, and others around the Seattle area.
Yeah, the one in West Seattle is at Alki Beach near the Liberty Statue. The one in Lower Queen Anne is at Counterbalance Park at Roy Street and Queen Anne Avenue North. And there's one at the MLK Memorial Park at 2200 MLK Way South.
Yes, as well as several
suburban
locations.
The main one is going to be in Occidental Square in Pioneer Square.
Yeah. And then the following day on Saturday, there is a Lights On for Detained People, which will not be a quiet vigil. You're encouraged to bring noisemakers. That will be outside the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, where immigrants are being held in what has been widely described as appalling conditions, not surprisingly. That's at 1623 East J Street in Tacoma. And I think that's going to be a relatively large event. So bring your noisemakers and hang out and let people inside know that there are people who care about them.
Yeah. Also next Saturday is a pancake breakfast benefit for Nicholsville from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Nicholsville Northlake Tiny House Village. That's at 3814 4th Avenue Northeast in the Northlake neighborhood.
Yeah, they will let you in. They just won't let HSD or Lehigh in.
Yeah, and also next Saturday is the Community Alliance for Global Justice's 13th annual benefit dinner. This year's speaker is Doria Robinson. She's executive director of Urban Tilth. She'll be talking about agroecology and its role in addressing climate change. That's from 5 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at St. Demetrio's Greek Orthodox Church, 2100 Boyer Avenue East on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, and we'll announce that again next week. The Community Alliance for Global Justice is a great group.
So, you know, next Saturday you could have your breakfast and your dinner taken care of.
Yeah, and go down to Tacoma for a picnic in between.
In between, yep.
All right. So we will plan on seeing you again next week.
Oh, yes. No, this was it.
All right. No,
yeah,
we'll be
I'll be back.